This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans. And its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This, Canby. I am your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. More than half of the population of Canby's zip code has been vaccinated for COVID-19, according to data from the Oregon Health Authority. The latest from OHA shows that 12,156 Canby residents have received at least the first dose of the vaccine, which translates to 50.4% of the total population. That calculation includes youth between the ages of 12 and 15 who may receive only the Pfizer-BioNTech jab, and children younger than 12 who are currently ineligible to receive any vaccine. These ineligible groups are not included in the county and statewide metrics the governor's office is using for reopening decisions. Once Clackamas County's eligible population, 16 and older, surpasses 65%, the county will automatically enter the low-risk level, which would allow restaurants, gyms, theaters, event venues, and other businesses to operate at up to half capacity. When the state hits 70% or more of adults, that's 18+, the risk level system will disappear entirely, allowing businesses to operate at full occupancy and potentially paving the way for a summer with fewer restrictions than Oregonians have seen since the pandemic began 15 months ago. According to the OHA's zip code-specific data, the Canby area is about par for the course with the rest of the county, with most communities in the 40 to 50% range. The highest vaccination rates are in the highly urban and more heavily populated northwest corner of Clackamas County, including Wilsonville at 60.6%, West Lynn at 64.9%, and Lake Oswego at 66.4%. The combined zip codes of 97034 and 97036, which encompasses parts of West Lynn, Milwaukee, and Lake Oswego, were at the highest at almost 80%, while the small community of Mount Hood Village in the Welch's area was an East County outlier with 1,261 of its 1,748 residents, that's 72.3%. They've all received the vaccine. The high percentage in that zip code, 97067, was likely helped by there being fewer children living in that area. The lowest rates are currently found in three southeastern county zip codes, where only about a third of the approximately 22,000 residents have been vaccinated. At least 30 Canby area residents' deaths were linked to COVID-19 during the coronavirus pandemic, a highly disproportionate number based on county data and the community's population. At just over 18,000 souls, Canby represents barely 4% of Clackamas County's population of more than 420,000. That would suggest that Canby would account for 10 or 11 of the county's 223 COVID-related deaths. But the city has actually experienced at least 30 deaths, or 13.5% of the county's figure. To make matters worse, the number of county residents who died of or with COVID-19 is likely higher than 30. Because the state and county do not provide death data at the community level, that number represents only those whose deaths were traced to outbreaks at two Canby long-term care facilities. The vast majority, 26, was linked to two separate outbreaks that occurred last year at Marquee Hope Village. Four additional deaths were traced to countryside living in downtown Cambie, according to Oregon Health Authority data. Any other Cambie residents whose deaths were linked to the virus would represent an even larger share of the county's mortality rate. On the other hand, some long-term care residents, particularly those who were at the post-acute rehab facility on a temporary basis, may have just had permanent homes outside of Cambie. An outbreak at the Marquee Hope Village Post-Acute Rehab Center last June became one of the largest in the state, infecting 113 people and killing 18, according to state data. A second outbreak in November sickened 49, with 8 deaths. Fortunately, Marquee and Cambie's other care homes were aggressive in making the vaccine available to their residents and staff in January and February of this year, and not a single outbreak has occurred in these facilities in 2021, according to the OHA. Clackamas County Commissioner Mark Scholl was stripped of his board authority and liaison assignments Tuesday morning in the wake of a controversial resolution he submitted that repeatedly likened the use of a vaccine passport to Jim Crow laws, which legally enforced racial segregation and discrimination against Black Americans in some areas of Reconstruction during the 1960s. 4 times, Scholl's resolution references Jim Crow, the name of laws that some southern states and communities imposed on newly freed slaves and their descendants, mandating separate public schools, parks, bus transportation, restrooms, seating in restaurants, and even water fountains for Black and white people. The resolution draws a clear comparison to the so-called vaccine passport policy in Oregon, which allows businesses and indoor event venues to let fully vaccinated patrons enter unmasked if they show proof of immunization. COVID-19 vaccine passports and segregation and discrimination based on an individual's COVID-19 vaccination status create the conditions of a new Jim Crow 2.0, Scholl's draft resolution stated. All 4 of his fellow commissioners excoriated Scholl over this reference to Jim Crow, with Commissioner Paul Savas decrying its, quote, tremendous racist implications, and not for the first time. You see, Scholl was formally censured by the board and was the subject of county and statewide calls for his resignation shortly after taking office in January, when Islamophobic and racist statements he'd made over a period of several years surfaced on social media. On Tuesday, few were harsher in their rebukes than Chair Tootie Smith, who admitted she would have been in favor of a ban on vaccine passports had Scholl presented it without the racist analogies to Jim Crow, which she decried as abhorrent and irresponsible. "You don't throw gasoline on a fire and then expect to retract the statement," Smith said. "Mark Scholl, you have been through so much, and at times my heart has bled for you. I have given you allowances. I have supported you, and you should know better. I do not think vaccines should be mandatory. It is still a choice, and I will fight for that right as long as I'm here. But I will not tolerate the language of this resolution from anybody, including you, sir. It will not see today. It is dead." Savas criticized the timing of Scholl's resolution just after the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, which sparked prolonged nationwide protests against systemic racism, and just ahead of Juneteenth, a date marking the end of slavery in the United States. "The timing couldn't be worse, in my opinion," said Savas. "That's all I have to say." But Scholl was not cowed, maintaining that the references to Jim Crow had, quote, nothing to do with racism. "It has to do with the restriction of civil liberties based on a law from a state," he said. "That is all. Jim Crow laws started after Reconstruction and lasted 87 years. That was my reference for this, that when you pass a law to restrict civil liberties, they don't go away anytime soon." Scholl said he believed Clackamas Countyans who have experienced racial discrimination would side with him in opposing a vaccine passport. "This was a draft document to stimulate discussion, and that's what it's done," he said. "I would submit that the people of color in this county would be the most against civil restrictions based on a passport. They would understand what I'm referring to when I refer to those southern laws that restricted civil liberties." "Well, Commissioner Scholl, you're getting your wish because this certainly has stimulated concerns right across America," Smith shot back. "You will answer for this, and you will answer alone." It was then that Smith moved to strip Scholl's committee and liaison assignments, which include the Clackamas County Fair Board and the Parks Advisory Board. Commissioner Sonia Fisher did not mince words, telling her colleague he should work harder to constrain the bigotry that comes out of your mouth. It cannot represent Clackamas County, she said. Three commissioners voted with Smith to winnow Scholl's portfolio of responsibilities, with only Scholl himself voting no. This means you do not represent the Board of County Commissioners in your dealings, Smith said. Thank you very much. Scholl's resolution was evidently modeled on a similar document that Yamhill County Commissioners passed last week, which contains identical language about Jim Crow laws, along with a reference to post-World War II Nuremberg Code that Clackamas County's draft omitted. Scholl's version, however, still contains two references to Yamhill County residents that were apparently left in by mistake. The 18-year-old driver who allegedly spun his car into oncoming traffic near Milo McIver State Park in unincorporated Clackamas County on Memorial Day, killing three teenagers and injuring himself and one other, has been arrested on numerous charges, including manslaughter. Devin Michael Kurtz, 18, has been booked in the Clackamas County Jail on three counts of second-degree manslaughter, driving under the influence of intoxicants, third-degree assault, recklessly endangering, reckless driving, and criminal mischief. The crash happened just after 9 p.m. Monday. Investigators said Kurtz was behind the wheel with four passengers, some as young as 14 years old, when he lost control of his car at the intersection of South Springwater Road and Redland near Estacada and collided with an oncoming pickup. Two of the teenagers were declared dead at the scene, while a third was transported by life flight to a local hospital, where they also died. Kurtz reportedly suffered a punctured lung, and the fourth passenger was also hospitalized with undisclosed injuries. The driver of the pickup, a 27-year-old man whom authorities did not identify, was unhurt. He cooperated with authorities at the scene, police said. The Estacada School District says some of the victims were students. They had extra staff on hand Tuesday to offer support to their classmates. The Estacada School District is deeply grieved to learn of a tragic car accident involving students from our district and community, officials said on Facebook. Our thoughts are with the families impacted, and we ask for your care and compassion on their behalf and on behalf of our schools as we all navigate this devastating news. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and Clackamas Fire responded to the scene. The County Medical Examiner's Office and Criminal Reconstruction and Forensic Technicians team arrived later to document the scene, conduct witness interviews, and collect and process the evidence. Authorities have not released the names of the other youths who were involved in the crash. Kurtz is being held on a $780,000 bail. The Oregon Senate on Tuesday unanimously passed House Bill 2168, making Juneteenth, a Texas-centered observance marking the end of slavery in the United States, an official state holiday every June 19th beginning in 2022. Lawmakers said the holiday will serve to honor the freedom of enslaved people in the United States, acknowledge Oregon's racist roots, and celebrate the contribution of Black Americans in the face of inequity and systemic oppression. The Emancipation Proclamation news arrived in waves to the enslaved Black women and men of my family, Senator Lou Frederick, Democrat from Portland, said in a press release. Family stories say, joy was the first emotion, and next, skepticism. However, hope stood at the center of a possible future for my family and so many families. That hope continues to this day, and so does the skepticism. The two can dance together, and in that dance we can progress, and we can amplify hope. On June 19, 1865, Union General Gordon Granger rode into Galveston, Texas, and issued General Order No. 3, which required the immediate freedom of more than 250,000 enslaved African Americans in the Lone Star State. Union troops marched throughout Galveston to spread the word that all slaves were free. Juneteenth is also known as Emancipation Day, Jubilee Day, and Freedom Day. The holiday was introduced to Oregon in 1945 by Clara Peoples, who first celebrated Juneteenth during her work break at the Vanport Shipyards. HB 2168 officially recognizes peoples and other Black Oregonians who have made long-lasting contributions to Oregon's history and cultural legacy. Miss Clara Peoples is foundational to Oregon. Her family is the reason we have unofficially observed this holiday, and the Peoples have remained central in framing the expectation of a more equitable tomorrow, Frederick said. Oregon was the only state to enter the Union with Black exclusion laws prohibiting Black Americans from owning property or making contracts, which, though they appear to have been rarely enforced, remained on the books for decades. In the 1920s, Oregon had the largest Ku Klux Klan membership per capita in the United States. And the state's constitution was drafted with racially charged language such as Negroes, Mulattoes, and Whites, which was not removed until 2002. Juneteenth is not the date all slaves were freed, Frederick acknowledged. Juneteenth is not the date that Black Americans or Black Oregonians were guaranteed comfort, relief, or safety. But Juneteenth was a step forward and a marker of hope, and one we must continue to build upon. This official holiday will recognize the people of Oregon, despite our past, can take the veil of ignorance away, and each year choose to have hope on Juneteenth and every day thereafter. The bill will head back to the House for a concurrence vote on a minor amendment before heading to Governor Kate Brown for her signature. And that'll do it for the news on this episode of Now Hear This, Camby. I'm James Walton. As always, thanks for listening and have a great day.
Hey, Tyler, I was reading an article the other day and I saw that 53% of Americans say they value technology even more since the COVID outbreak.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that article in Obvious News Weekly.
Okay, you don't have to be mean.
Seriously, though, it is true. I know that I can't function anymore without all of my connected devices. And I heard that DirectLink saw a huge spike in internet traffic after the stay-at-home order began last year.
Yeah, it's a good thing DirectLink works hard to provide constant, reliable broadband service even during tough weather, peak use hours, and that big jump in increased demand.
Right, and we need access to a quality connection more than ever. We're working from home, the kids are still distance learning, and I've even had a few online doctor's appointments.
Yeah, not only that, but so many of our entertainment options have gone virtual. There's streaming TV shows and movies, Zoom game nights, and online gaming, so people really need reliable internet.
Wait. With all of that extra online activity going on, don't we have to worry about usage limits and high bills from using too much data?
Come on, Tyler. How many times have we been over this? DirectLink doesn't have data caps and doesn't charge extra fees for high usage. It says so right there on their website. Visit directlink.coop today to learn more. All right, well, joining us once again on the Now Hear This Can Be podcast is Chris Helbling of Whiskey Hill Winery. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while. It's been before COVID and everything.
Well, the last 18 months has kind of blown by, so it seems
yeah,
like yesterday.
Right. True. Fair point. So we're all just going to talk a lot of wine, but I know that one thing I wanted to ask you about first is something you've been involved with for a few years, Canby basketball.
Yeah.
They're having a good season this year.
They are. They're doing fantastic. They have a great group of kids. They are, oh man, this is pulling this off the top of my head now, 4-2.
Yeah.
And they've been playing really, really great.
And they're at least one of their losses was West Lynn, just barely, like at the buzzer. I think it went into overtime.
That one was a fantastic game.
It would have
Diego
been
Arredondo missed a three at the buzzer to take it to overtime.
Right.
And their other loss was to
but
Sherwood.
But they're one of the best teams in the state, West Lynn.
Probably,
yeah.
Yeah. And then their other loss was to Sherwood, and that was a double overtime loss.
Right.
And they're also up there.
Right. So even better, year, so. That's a good record, but even better than that record might suggest. Yes, so and Diego, oh my gosh, that kid.
Yeah, he's good.
All right, well, wine. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about how you guys have been doing, how it's been as a small winemaker and a producer of grapes for a number of other wineries amid COVID, and then we'll talk about the wildfires as well.
Wine has been an interesting 18 months, just like everything else.
Yeah.
So going into last year, right about this time, we had a little bit of hail that came through the area. And so when hail comes through right about the time where we are right now, which is bloom and pollination, when the hail hits that stuff and knocks everything off, it's going to decrease the yield because there's not as much of, the grapes don't have as much of an ability to pollinate.
Okay.
And so we were already looking to be down about 40% by the time the fires came.
Okay.
And so if there was going to be a year where we ended up having tons of smoke damage, 2020 was the one already. And then fires came, and so
Summer, obviously, you make a lot, you do a lot of business through your tasting room and whatnot, and that was obviously severely impacted by,
you know, it for the first that March until kind of midsummer. It was pretty slow, but then it was relatively busy for the for the rest of the year, which kind of helped make up for that. So it kind of evened out in the long run.
But, okay, good.
Once everything came and everybody got outside, it was okay.
I know a lot of, you know, liquor stores, grocery stores, and places that sell alcohol actually ended up doing pretty well last year. Were you able to tap into some of that through other ways of selling your products?
I think that's what helped balance things in the long run. We did some fun stuff. We did some virtual wine tasting.
Okay.
And so we did stuff on Zoom. We did a virtual wine blending. So that was actually fun. We did.
Explain how that works. I'm sure some people are imagining, like, computer chips being implanted into your brain.
Yeah. No, this was on Zoom. Yeah, everybody who bought Zoom stock is happy.
Yes.
So we went and we did four components of our red blend. So we did a Marechal Foch, a Leon Mio, a Syrah, and a Pinot, all bottled separately.
And you distributed them out through like Wayward Sandwiches and places, right?
So that was a little bit different one. Did a six pack of local wines. They were awesome. Yeah, they did. They had us in two local six packs of local wines. I think King's Raven was in there, and St. Joe's, and a couple others also.
Nice.
But this one we did a 375 milliliter bottle, so a half bottle of each of the red blend components,
okay,
and then a bottle of our red blend. And what we did is we sent that home with everybody, and then everybody got on Zoom, and we gave them little graduated cylinders and all kinds of plastic stuff to measure. And then we did this whole basically class on wine blending. And so we taught everybody what we look for in wine blending, what one grape lacks for, we can make up with another grape, and why red blends end up being tasting really good is because you can do that. You can make up for what one lacks.
Wow, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and well, nobody had to drive, and so people went through a lot of wine. And so we got done, and we actually ended up with a new label out of it. We were telling the story about how we re-sided the winery, and we re-sided it red, so the boys called the barn Big Red. We're talking to the neighbor while this is going on, and he tells us that there were stalls in the barn. Well, we knew there were stalls in the barn. Tells us that these stalls in the barn were actually for donkeys and not for horses. And so one of our wine club members, while we're doing this, shouts out that we need a big ass red blend. And so we have a new red blend that is it has a donkey butt on the label.
Love it. That's great. But doesn't have hints of donkey butt.
Just fruity notes and happiness.
How many folks did you have for that?
We did like 25 on those. Awesome. And then we started doing some virtual cooking classes. We actually have one on Saturday.
Yeah.
And those are kind of fun. Everybody goes. And my cousin happens to be a chef. So like all good ideas, they come with drinking wine. And so sitting around drinking wine at a Cascade Foothills meeting one night next door, and I was like, well, we could do a cooking class, pair it with wine, and do that on Zoom. So we did a ton of those, and those were a lot of fun also.
That's cool. And that was just a way to kind of stay connected to folks and give people an outlet when
there's
so much other stuff.
We anticipated them going for like, so especially the blending and the first couple virtual tastings we did, we anticipated them going for about 45 minutes, maybe a half hour. They went for about 3.5 hours each. Because I mean, at that point, early on, everybody's so.
What else are we gonna do?
Yeah, exactly. We did. We were playing all kinds of games on there and talking, and it got kind of out of control.
Yeah. And it's one of those things. It definitely, there's a limit to how long that can be fun. But when you are in that place of, you know, that early pandemic, everything was canceled. We're all, you know, shut in.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of outlet feels amazing.
Oh, it was. It was a blast. We had a good time with it.
Yeah. Awesome. Let's start talking again about the grapes. You mentioned that way before we knew what the wildfire season was going to be like, you were already facing some challenges. COVID wouldn't have impacted that too much. You have a smaller kind of crew, not big, you know, kind of factory work or anything that would have been
impacted
by social distancing or anything like that. So
yeah, yields being down was already, and that was a valley-wide thing, and that's part of farming. That doesn't have anything to do with COVID. That's right. You have good years and bad years, and
right.
That was going to be a bad year already.
Yeah.
And then the smoke coming along was an interesting.
What about the climate until we got to the smoke?
Doing great.
Going to be
the small yield. We were looking to be yield, but very good actually picked our two hybrids, Leon Mill and Marischal Foch, right before the fires. And
okay.
So those are in barrel right now, and those are actually tasting fantastic.
But yeah.
They were the week before the fires.
Okay. So for folks who don't understand, why is wildfire such a big impact or such a big concern for grape growers, wine growers?
So what's interesting about wildfires, and it's really the smoke from the wildfires that's a problem. Obviously, if they get to the winery, that's a problem also.
Like you guys are not immune for fire, right?
No.
No, but the ash and the debris and the smoke.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Oregon area is that, aside from some wineries that buy fruit from Southern Oregon, where they've had fires the last couple of years, and at least I don't have almost any experience with working with smoke-impacted fruit. And so it was really interesting to go through everything and learn. And so we were fortunate that another winery was able to purchase most of our grapes, who has a lab on site and can adjust everything. Us being very small, we don't have that capability.
Right.
And so we did two experimental wines out of the harvest to try and play with everything, but all the rest of the grapes left.
I imagine folks that aren't farmers would think, so like, what's the big deal? I mean, it was obviously scary at the time, but it was a couple weeks that kind of passed. But it's because the smoke and especially the debris get on the skins and get on the actual fruit that then go into the wine, because it happened right at the time that you would have been harvesting.
Smoke, basically, it was at the worst possible time.
Yeah.
So right there, right before harvest, is where the skin of the grape will actually absorb some of those molecules that we can taste and perceive.
Rinse off.
No, well, so the ash will fall off.
Yeah.
And so we tried to get most of that. So the skin of the grape absorbs a bunch of that stuff. And so once the skin breaks and you have the juice contact the skin, you're going to start soaking up that that taste and odor. And so we did a couple of things differently. To go back a little bit, and the big effect is proximity, intensity, and duration of the smoke. And so because we're, I don't know how far from Glen Avon, 8 miles, 10 miles maybe, from there. So we're relatively close to where the fire's going. And then the duration was long. We had that fresh smoke for 4 days before it circled back out over the Pacific and came back. And then the intensity was pretty intense smoke.
Yeah.
And so we had pretty much the perfect storm. Well, and then on top of that, we had the atmospheric been hunted out in the sun all day. Brains fried. Atmospheric inversion that pushed it all back down on top of us.
I think people just thought, well, you're making red wine, you've got red sky, that would only help.
Exactly. If it looks like the surface of Mars, it's got to be good. It was difficult. And so
when you're making Pinots and red wine, folks may not know, you make them with the skins. You leave that in.
So there was a lot of theories about how to adjust everything. We went with a couple different things. So we made two experimental wines. We made a Riesling and we made a white Pinot Noir. Both of them we knew were going to be heavily smoke impacted. And the way we knew this is shortly after the fires, we went and we did these bucket ferments. So we took 5 gallon buckets and did mini ferments in them. And the reason we did that as opposed to sending samples to a lab is because at one point it was almost faster to send frozen samples to Australia than it was to get tests done in Oregon, because the labs were so backlogged. And so these 5 gallon bucket ferments, we would take, ferment our red grapes in there, rush it through as fast as we can, kind of get a worst case scenario. And we tasted everything that we had from our fruit, and we were very unhappy with what would have been the final result. And so we decided to do white wines. The reason the white wines is because you have very minimal amount of skin contact. So as soon as the skin breaks, we're getting that juice away from the skins already, and making something.
You're reminding me of this guy. He used to make hard cider out in Aurora. I'm not sure if he's still doing it, but He's originally from Ireland, and he was telling the story about how he first got into making hard cider when he was a kid, and they did it in a bucket under his bed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a wonder we didn't, like, kill ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, man. It sounds like a glamorous process. And when we say buckets, they were literally 5-gallon Homer buckets.
Yeah.
So, it's what you got to do to test that stuff out. And it's not like you're, again, we're not serving this to people. This was just to experiment with and see where we would land.
Yeah, we got you.
So we went with white Pinot and Riesling.
And it was just, I guess obviously the decision in some wineries, I know, like you've mentioned, in Southern Oregon, have also had to make we just lost this year's harvest, you know. You were kind of faced with that possible prospect, and how can we salvage something and not just, you know, toss all this year's hard work in the garbage.
Well, exactly. And so, like I said, we were very fortunate that one of our normal grape buyers was able to take most of everything. And so we were still able to get rid of that stuff. But as far as me, I'm making wine for ourselves. After anything in 2020, you just laugh and smile and look at it, be like, what else would it be to make wine in 2020?
Right. Why would we think this would not be horrible?
Yeah. And so we did something, experiment with it, learn from it, move on, and hold on to the information for when it happens again. Hopefully never again.
You were, in your previous life, you were a county deputy.
Yes.
You kind of trained in chaos and
exactly.
difficult situations. do you feel like 2020, do you feel like that prepared you for 2020, or did you end up learning stuff from 2020 as well, your outlook or things is a little bit different than it was before everything that happened last year?
Probably a lot less stressed when something happens.
Yeah.
It's crisis fatigue by the time you get done with anything. You're like, of course this is happening right now. Yeah. Like when the ice storm came. Of course. Of course we don't have power for 12 days.
Yeah.
What else would be happening?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just smile and laugh and
it gives
open
you
a bottle of wine.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you some interesting perspective. Something bad happens. I was like, well, it's not as bad as last year. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Still better than 2020.
Could be worse.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys are actually doing some tasting and some kind of events this summer for the smoke impacted wines that you made, and kind of using it as a cool opportunity to educate people about the winemaking process in general and about how smoke impacts grapes.
Yep. And so we're doing a flight. It's two wines, and then it comes with a little pamphlet that's got some information on there about the smoke impact and what we did winemaking wise. And the entire event. And so the idea is, these aren't finished wines that we're bottling and sending home. They're just really small batch things that everybody can taste, try, and kind of see what we got as a result. And so we did things a little bit differently on both of them. One of them's a little more impacted than the other one. But the thing with smoke is, like, we'll get 10 of us and we'll sit around and everybody will try the same wine in front of everybody. And everybody will write down a blind number on a scale of 1 to 10. And it seems like every time we do that, somebody's a 10, somebody's a 1, and everywhere in between. And so it's there. And these are them if you want to try. This is the Riesling that we did.
Okay.
And so this sad note about this is our first ever picking of this Riesling.
Oh.
So
well, it can only go uphill from
here. Exactly.
I wish you guys could see. He gave me this, like, fishbowl-sized glass and then poured, like, a little puddle of wine into it.
These are the fancy Oregon Riedel Oregon Pinot glasses. Or they're not called the Oregon Pinot glasses anymore. They changed the name. They're the New World Pinot glasses.
Oh, okay.
But
this, I'm going to guess, is the lesser impacted one. It is. It looks just like a normal Riesling.
Well, so your color is not going to change as much. The color is going to be pretty consistent.
I don't smell
pretty
a lot
consistent.
Of smoke either.
When I smell it, I get smoke for sure. And so that might be like smoke ingrained in my brain from doing this all the time that it's just there.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, it's totally, you get 10 different people and 10 different people are going to get 10 different perceptions of it.
I can maybe pick up a tiny hint of smoke if I really pretend.
Think about it and look for it.
Yeah. If I really try to key in on it.
Well, in these, so I, temperature, so if we have them refrigerated and we cool them way down, it'll actually cover up a little bit of it because temperature will mask some flavors and aromas sometimes, and so these are actually room temperature right now, which for right now is kind of hot.
And list longtime listeners will know that I have the palate of a caveman. I mean, yeah. I can say nothing intelligent or helpful when it comes to tasting wines, which is funny that I do this pretty often. But
well, that's the funny thing about wine is like everybody thinks that you have to have something intelligent to say about wine or something. Yeah. And I'm bad at identifying flavors in wine. I can't do it at all.
Right.
I can identify faults. Like if something is oxidized and it smells like salad dressing, I can get that one.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
if you know, there's other things going on, I can get that stuff. But as far as like smelling something,
you're,
and tell
you're
you this
like
has
me
notes
with music.
Of...
I can tell when something's out of key, but I can't sing on key.
Yep. Exactly. This smells and tastes funny. It needs to go to a lab.
Yeah. Right. All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
See what we got here.
So yeah, a little bit smoky. What you'll get in what I, or at least what I usually get. I get everybody gets something different. Is yeah, a little bit of that smell, and then a little bit of the smoky taste, like kind of on the back sides of my tongue is where I get it, and it kind of lingers and it sits there, and it's yeah, it's not overly intense, but you can definitely taste it a little bit.
Yeah, I think the longer it lingers, the more you can pick up on that a little bit. So if you just want to have a good wine, just drink it quick, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just chug it down.
Second bottle of the night.
But yeah, the acidity seems pretty normal.
Oh yeah. So I mean, as far as the wine goes, outside of the smoke, we're pleased with where everything landed. It's just, I mean, the smoke is there. And so so in dealing with smoke, there's a couple of different theories out there, and but the hard part is they strip everything out of it, so it's hard to get in there and isolate just the smoke and get it out.
Right, you take out the other flavors.
Yeah.
I mean, I would almost say, again, not being a huge wine person, but it doesn't taste bad. It's not like, you know, like this is ruined or
you know,
it just feels like it adds a different, interesting element that you wouldn't normally anticipate being there, but you're not, totally unwelcome to it.
Yeah,
and this is your worst.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's pretty good.
I mean, it goes up and down. So like, that's the other weird thing about this stuff is, I've gone out there and over the course of 10 days, try it every day and see where it's at and rate it myself. And it does. And
that's
funny. It's probably
and are you sure
more.
It's not just different grapes reacting differently, or to that.
Nope. It. No. I mean, it's all sitting there in the tank and it's sampled from the same spot.
Oh, gotcha. This is after harvest.
And, and. Some days I'm like, this is a 10, we could bottle this. And then other days I'm like, I need to trip over the valve on my
this
way
is
out.
This is going for barbecue sauce. Yeah.
This is food wine. Cooking wine.
Yeah.
But,
all right, what do we got here?
So this one's the other one. This one is, a Pinot Noir grape, and we made a white Pinot Noir out of it. And so it is...
That's where it gets that rosy hue.
Yeah, and so, and the way we did this, it's kind of a little bit between where we'd normally make our white Pinot and where we'd make our rosé. So normally we make white Pinot, we won't take any of the pressings from that process. And so we'll load all the Pinot in the press. Everything that falls off the press will pump into a tank, and then the pressings we'll put into rosé. Whereas this stuff, we had to press it a little bit to get enough out of everything because we didn't have a ton of grapes left.
Yeah.
But a little bit more body in this one, a lot more color. I don't get as much of the aroma. 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And then
I feel
sometimes
like I smell a little more smoke with this one.
See, that's the
it could be just you poured me a little more wine this time. Thank you.
Yeah. Bigger sample bottle. But there's you get a little bit of it covering, you still get some of the
it's the aroma is more fruit than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get that for sure, but
and see, I'm the opposite on this one. But I've also had the other way where I'll smell this one and I think it's way more. And that's why it goes back and forth. And that's one of the reasons we won't bottle it because, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody opens
like
a bottle.
I taste a little more smoke with this one too.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. Yeah. But good. Again, it's not like, spit it out. But
yeah, it's an interesting one to play with. And it's kind of fun to see what comes from everything. And it really is different by the day.
But I wonder if it obviously if you're just drinking on its own merits, that's one thing, but when you start talking about food pairings, if there's interesting stuff you can do with smoke impacted wines,
we're doing this one with
barbecue.
Pizza this weekend.
Oh, there you go. Pizza. Okay.
With our cooking class.
Yeah. Love it.
But it is funny, talking to people as they've done this flight over the past couple of weeks, and it is all the way from 0 to 10. We have people who describe it as having a peaty, kind of scotchy taste to
it. Yeah, I can see that.
And love it and want to buy it by the case.
Yeah, that earthiness, yeah.
Yeah, and then we have people who are like, wow, this is smoky.
don't love it. Yeah, I can see it being polarizing in that way, too. It's definitely, again, interesting. Maybe not my favorite thing I've ever tasted, to be completely brutally honest.
Yeah, me either. That's why I'm not bottling it.
Well, I do love that you guys are, taking lemons and making lemonade, or taking smoke ruined grapes and making, your best wine with it. I do think that it's fun to, it's cool to try and make something fun and interesting out of something that was in a lot of ways obviously bad and scary and very impactful to some folks. What kind of reactions or things have you heard from people? What has been the experience so far? I know this is going to be kind of continuing into the summer, but you've been doing it for a little while.
People really like it. The most common thing we get is people want to buy bottles and take the pamphlet with them,
or take samples
of it with them to share with other people. And I mean,
this is like the most in-depth, informative, thing a winery has ever given me.
Usually
it's like a postcard with some flowery history notes. Of like. I was born in the mountains of,
we're going to tell you exactly what's going on. That's the other thing. We're always trying. I mean, wine tasting, when you go around and you do a bunch of different stuff, I mean, especially in the Wine Valley, it's Pinot everywhere. And
right.
So, I mean, that's one of the cool parts about being in the Cambie area is that all of the wineries around here are tasting stuff that is not just Pinot. There's so much other stuff to go do, but you go do that enough times and you just get tasted out tasting the same stuff because wine is vintage. So, I mean, you got to wait another year before vintages are coming out or new whites or new reds. And so to do something different that's outside of the norm, at least for us tasting wise, has been really, really cool and really well accepted so far.
Cool. Anything else you guys got going on this summer, this year, that you want to tell people about?
That's it, man.
Okay.
Wine tasting and all kinds of excitement. Endless weddings at the wedding.
yes, which is great. Yeah. I'm glad that's coming back here at Whiskey Hill and Post Waits. So tell folks how they can get in touch, where you're located, what your hours are.
Yep, we're on Barlow Road, so as you're leaving Canby, going south on 99, turn left on Barlow, you'll see St. Joseph's and us right down as you pass Zimmerman.
The first sign you see is not the one you turn at. Keep going.
Yeah.
To the next left.
Or at least come to us after you stop in there. Maybe the
the first post-await sign you see.
Oh, yeah. Next left.
Yes. Yeah. No, St. Joseph's is great as well.
Our website online at whiskeyhillwinery.com, and then our tasting room is open every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 12 to 5.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And finally, on this episode, we conclude with Canby Then, which is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily, you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. If you're a longtime listener of our history series, you know the city was originally known as Baker Prairie, probably named after James Baker, one of the area's earliest pioneers. What you might not know is that Jim Baker was also one of the most colorful figures in the old frontier West. Also known as Big Jim and Honest Jim, he was a frontiersman, trapper, hunter, fur trader, explorer, army scout, interpreter, soldier, territorial militia officer, rancher, mine owner, toll keeper, and a mountain man who married not just one Native American bride, but perhaps as many as 20. Eat your hearts out, sister wives. He was born in Belleville, Illinois in 1808, though there were contemporary sources, however, that stated how Baker himself was not quite sure of his exact birth date or whether it was in the year 1808 or 1809. However, his childhood was documented, with his parents describing themselves as poor. Baker was one of many children in the family, and from an early age he excelled in fishing, and he also hunted squirrels, muskrats, and other small game using a gun. When he was 17, his father sent him to his grandfather in St. Louis for his education, but he was sent home after showing little interest in the instruction. During this journey, he met a capper who told him tales of adventure on the frontier. The young Baker needed no other encouragement. He went promptly to the offices of the American Fur Company and joined his first trapping expedition. It was as a fur trapper that he met the legendary Jim Bridger and Kit Carson, two larger-than-life figures who, sadly, never lived in Canby. But Big Jim Baker did. He settled here in the early 1830s and operated a huge ranch and farm on the rich lands that now form North Canby. He stayed until at least 1838, but the date that he left the area isn't known for sure. The records aren't exactly ironclad. What is certain is that Baker eventually tired of farming and left, selling his interest in the farm business to a man named W.C. Dement. He joined up with a large party headed for the annual trapper rendezvous in the Wyoming mountains, and from then on he would have had many adventures and exploits in the fur business. On May 25, 1839, he traveled up the Missouri to Kansas City on a steamer known as the St. Peter, eventually traveling to Grand Island on the Platte River, reaching the Laramie Plains. They continued down the Medicine Bow and Laramie Rivers to the Sweetwater River, crossing South Pass to arrive at Fort Bonneville. For at least a couple of years, Baker hunted and trapped in the Wind River Mountains with the legendary mountain man Jim Bridger. When spring broke in 1840, he returned home to Illinois. But by the following, Baker had set out again on his second journey to the Rocky Mountains, traveling back across the Laramie Plains, over South Pass, down the Green River, to Bridger's camp at the Henry's Fork. Bridger, who was worried about his associate Henry Frabe, sent Baker and others to search for the lost party who had been trapping at the base of the Squaw Mountain on the banks of the Little Snake River. In August 1841, Baker was involved in a violent clash at the junction of Battle Creek and the Snake River, when Baker's group of 35 trappers encountered a group of Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors. Frabe died early on in the fight, leaving Baker to take charge. This battle led to the Bastion Mountain being renamed Battle Mountain. After the warriors retreated on August 27th, the trappers departed from Battle Mountain and returned to Bridger's camp. Baker would go on to become a highly regarded U.S. Army scout and Indian interpreter for Generals John C. Fremont, William S. Harney, Albert Sidney Johnston, and George Armstrong Custer, thanks to his fluency in the Shoshone language and the use of the Arapaho Sign Language, as well as his knowledge of the rivers, trails, and mountains, all of which he'd picked up in the fur trade. In 1859, Baker took up a homestead near Denver, 3 miles north on Clear Creek. In 1864, he built an adobe brick building at what is now 53rd and Tennyson Streets, just west of the campus of Regis University. He built a toll bridge and owned the first coal mine in Colorado, where Riss is now, 18 miles west of Denver. In the same year, Baker was appointed a captain of the Colorado Militia along with John Chivington, who later led the Colorado Territorial Forces in the infamous Sand Creek Massacre. He would eventually ramble his way to a ranch near Savory, Wyoming, where he built a cabin from cottonwood trees with his three daughters, Isabel, Madeline, and Jenny. It was there that he became a beloved member of the community and picked up the nickname Honest Jim. His cabin had three stories. On the top one was built a watchtower, but as the likelihood of conflict with Native Americans had been greatly reduced, the third floor was eventually taken down. But conflict would still find him, as it turned out. Baker was an old man in 1875 when he was asked to serve under General Custer as a scout during the Battle of Rosebud in the Black Hills. In 1881, he was asked to scout in another battle, the Meeker Massacre, led by General Thornburg. On May 15, 1898, Baker died in his cabin on Carbon County, Wyoming. His body was buried in a small cemetery overlooking the Little Snake River Valley. A few years later, the Baker cabin was removed from Savory and taken to Frontier Park in Cheyenne, Wyoming. But in July 1976, the home of Jim Baker was returned to Savory, where it was incorporated into the Little Snake River Museum. The cabin was reconstructed under the direction of Jim Baker's great-grandson, Paul McAllister, who still lives in Dixon, Wyoming. And that does it for this episode. I'm James Walton. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yep. Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This Camby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Camby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.